We kicked off a brand new week right here on WICC 600 on Connecticut Today, keeping tabs on the ever-changing coronavirus situation. We spoke with a professor from the University of New Haven's Business School about the lasting effects on the sports world after COVID-19, both pro and college style. We spoke with a gentleman who was in a high position at the Akron Beacon Journal the day that the Kent State Massacre took place 50 years ago on May 4th, 1970. He has a fascinating new book out about that. And as always, we carry the comments and a daily update on the coronavirus from Governor Ned Lamont. Well, we still, despite all the planning and all the head-scratching by leagues and venues and everything, we are still in such a crazy time that if you pull away the NFL draft the other day, we still don't have any real sports happening out there to take people's minds off of this. What is going to have to happen venue-wise, liability-wise, to get this going again? We're joined by the chair and the professor of sports management in the business school at the University of New Haven. Gil Fried joins us. Gil, Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm trying, Gil. Listen, with the fact that there are no NHL playoffs this year, which for me, and I love all four sports, but that first round of the NHL playoffs, when you've got a game every night on like four different channels, that's pure unadulterated heaven for me. But it's not there, Gil. There's nothing going on. I mean, this is unprecedented here.
I've never seen this in my 30 years in the sport industry. Yeah, we've had strikes, but even when you've had a strike, you've had other things going on. Here, the only thing you can have is either virtual NASCAR racing or some horse racing going on, and that's it.
I kind of thought it was kind of cool what they did this past weekend, where they took some of the, I don't know whether folks saw this or not, but they took some of the greatest thoroughbreds of all time. I guess they dumped their stats into a computer with all their tendencies, and they had this all-star, like, Kentucky Derby, which was kind of cool, and what a shock, Secretariat won. I could have told you that one. Maybe the greatest horse of all time, but I don't know, Gil. And I give the networks credit for doing this, but is anybody watching this stuff, you think, or not?
I think there are so many diehard sport fans out there that need some kind of fix. And so they're willing to accept almost anything at this point, you know, as something that can provide value for them, that they could say, look, at you know what? I need something. And so even if it might be watching esports, and they might not be an esport fan, it's some kind of action. And some people are action you know, junkies, where they really need that. And so for some people, it's better than nothing, but it does take away. I mean, I haven't been watching any of these rebroadcasts of games from years past, because you know what happened. And while some games are great, it's not the same.
No, it's not. And, you know, Gil, part of the big thing, I think, here, beyond the actual playing of the games, and yeah, it's easy enough to get teams back together, whether it's Major League Baseball or local sports, say with you folks at, you know, UNH or Fairfield, Sacred Heart, Quinnipiac, Yale, you know, to get the teams back together and play all that, that's not the real tough part. The part is, what do you do about these venues? I mean, if you have a game, some people are going to say, okay, I'll take the risk, I'll wear a mask, I want to go out and watch a game because I'm dying to watch something. I don't know what colleges, teams, Gil, are going to do here in the immediate future, A, to keep their players protected, both men and women, but B, to run the venues in any sort of a cohesive way during all this.
I think they're going to have serious issues that they're going to be dealing with over the next couple of months, trying to determine, one, do you have tailgating as an example? You know, how do you have social distancing during tailgating? How do you screen people when they come in? Are you going to be screening them for temperature? Are you going to be screening them for any other signs of a potential virus? What if someone is sitting near you and they cough? You know, are you going to automatically call security and try to get the person escorted away? Is it because of possible the virus, or is it that they just swallowed incorrectly? Everyone's going to be taking a look at everybody else with a different eye. And this is not something that we've had in the past. And then you have the whole situation where if you're serving alcohol, people get intoxicated and they do stupid things, or they might get sick or whatever. That could raise a whole new spectra of potential concerns. How do you sit people together? You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to have two, three spaces between people where it's not just on the sides? You have to take a look at front and back as well. So I've seen some of the models that we've been discussing, and they're basically about one-tenth full the stadiums in order to comply with social distancing. If that's the case, stadiums can't make money. You can't open them up because you have to pay a certain amount of money to have enough people to work an event. And then you have all the cost of maintaining the, whether it's the grass turf or whether it's maintaining the ice. That all costs money. And if you're not going to be able to make enough money, why open it up? Because it'll affect parking. It'll affect concession sales. There's a ripple effect. You know, how much sales you'll have from the team stores. It all drops significantly. And that's what they're scared of.
I wanted to ask, you know, there's a thought among people that, well, you know, all these sports owners are very rich guys and gals, that, you know, the Jerry Joneses, the Steinbrenner families, the people who own the Red Sox, the Cubs, the Dodgers, all these teams, that, you know, the Knicks and New York, Jim Dolan. But, Gil, that's all predicated on some sort of cash flow. If you're going to pay a Major League Baseball team like the Yankees $250 million a year on for salary, you need some money coming in.
I mean, you're absolutely correct. If you're looking at all the money that is being spent on sports, you can't have those exorbitant salaries without having exorbitant income coming in. And this goes not just to all the big professional teams, but also to the college teams. If you take a look at the expenses associated with a college athletic program, the biggest one is grant and aid. So you're paying for the tuition for all these students. You need revenue coming in to be able to offset that. Same with the salaries. So we're going to be trying to take a look at where can we generate additional revenue. And I think one of the biggest issues we're going to have is that people are not going to want to pay as much to go to games in the future. And so the industry has basically priced itself into a corner where they've made themselves the bastion for the ultra rich and the people in the luxury seating and stuff like that. And that's fine. But when things are tough, you know, how can a family of four afford going to an NFL game when the typical cost is over $1,000 when you include all the expenses? So they're going to have to do something to reduce the cost to make it better and easier for fans to want to go to the game.
So you think that one of the results of this whole coronavirus thing, Gil, even if it gets down to a local level here, if people going to a game, say, at Fairfield or Quinnipiac or Yale or University of Bridgeport or whatever, tickets will have to be made cheaper as an enticement to get people back in the venues?
Yeah, I personally foresee about a 20% drop in ticket prices. And across the board, from the high end to the low end, people are going to be more value conscious coming out of this, especially those that have lost work. And if you say, hey, look, we want you to come here, but we want you to pay $200 for a ticket, the average Joe fan is not going to be there. And a lot of businesses, especially the mom and pop businesses who have been the backbone of season ticket and condensed season ticket packages, they're going to say, look, we can't afford this now. And so I think there's going to be a realignment of ticket pricing, and it's going to be significant pain for a number of entities, where, especially the minor leagues, where they don't have the revenue stream from broadcasting and other sources.
And, Gil, finally, I can see one upside to this, and I'm sure you've thought about it. When, in fact, something starts up again in some league, in some way, whether it's the NBA or the NHL or baseball or football, I don't know about you. I think the television ratings here and the radio ratings are going to go through the roof here because people are so desperate to have something.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. I think the broadcasting side is going to create a lot of opportunities. I think the gambling side is also going to be taking off like crazy because there's so much pent-up demand for people who wanted to gamble on March Madness and then they didn't have that opportunity, or the NBA or NHL playoffs. So there's a number of different demand areas I think are going to be increasing the sport context. But I could see broadcasting really growing, and that will possibly lead to more entities like Facebook and Twitch and other online streaming platforms like Amazon coming in and trying to buy rights because they need new content.
Interesting. We'll keep an eye on that. Gil Fried, Chair and Professor of Sports Management in the College of Business at the University of New Haven. Gil, thank you. Fascinating stuff. Take care of yourself. We'll be in touch. Thanks, Gil.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Our next guest was curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University from 2000 till 2011. Now, he came to Harvard after a distinguished career in the newspaper business for over 40 years, but one of his stops included the Akron Beacon Journal. And while he was there, he and his staff were tasked with covering a story that was a major tragedy that has been interwoven in the psyche of America now for 50 years, as we look back 50 years as to what happened at Kent State University. Robert Giles is the guest. He has a new book out about that. The title of the book is When Truth Matter, The Kent State Shootings 50 Years Later. Robert Giles, thank you and welcome to WICC. How are you?
Fine, Paul. How are you? It's nice to be talking to another newsman.
Yeah, it's too late for law school, Bob. That's what I always say. Boy, Bob, Kent State, there are few things in the history of this country, Bob, where all you have to do is mention a few words, 9/11, Pearl Harbor, and this, Kent State, a relatively, at least until then, Bob, obscure school in Ohio, correct?
Absolutely. It was a small state university. It had grown a lot during the 1970s, 60s and 70s. State money had enabled the university to build many new buildings. So it was a university of about 19,000 students in May of 1970.
Now, you were a young reporter at the Akron Beacon Journal, and obviously I've done a little work in newspapers, too, and obviously protests and what's happening on local college campuses is part of the grind of covering the local scene, which many newspapers do well. Was the Kent State campus prior to this, Bob, was it a scene of a lot of protests in the Vietnam era?
Yes, it was. There had been a continuing stream of protests during the mid-60s to 1970, and we covered them all. We were really prepared in May of 1970 for anything that might happen. Obviously, we couldn't anticipate shooting and killing students, but we knew there was going to be a major demonstration on May 4th, and growing out of anger over President Nixon's speech sending troops into Cambodia.
Now, did you folks in the newsroom there at the Akron Beacon Journal, did you have, you know, pretty good contacts with the student organizers? Did you have any sort of relationship or connection to them? Were they telling you what was going to happen?
We had a long-standing relationship with the leaders of the protest movement at Kent State, and they were all mostly students, although the public perceived that there were radicals, Students for Democratic Society and so on, who were involved behind the scenes and causing trouble at Kent State. But the demonstration on May the 4th was mostly students who simply were infuriated by Nixon's decision, and also they were very upset about the draft.
So would you say there might have been, Bob, looking back, a little bit of a misconception maybe of who some of the Vietnam protesters were? Because I know a lot of people back then, and you can see it in the media coverage and in the writings, they were, I think, branded too often as, you know, these anti-American communists, but you're saying it's not the case.
Well, it was not the case at Kent State. I mean, there had been There was a unit of the Students for a Democratic Society on the campus, but they were not a powerfully persuasive group. One of the things that happened the day after Nixon's speech was on April 30th. On May the 1st, a group of students gathered on the campus. They had a shovel. They dug a hole. They buried the U.S. Constitution and said that because this was an undeclared war on the Cambodians, they were going to bury the Constitution. Nixon had basically destroyed it. But that was at the heart of the kind of protest that was alive on the Kent State campus in 1970.
So May 4th rolls around, Bob Giles, and you're working at the Akron Beacon Journal. And what was your staffing like that day, and who was actually covering what was going on for you on the editorial side and on the photo side as well?
Well, I was the managing editor of the paper at the time, and I was in charge of the coverage. We had a plan for the demonstration that had been scheduled for noon on May the 4th, Monday, May the 4th. We staffed it. We didn't anticipate anything major happening, but we staffed it with a single reporter and two photographers. The reporter was a Kent State journalism student who had been stringing for us, working for us during his college years. And he was on the campus that day, and he did some extraordinary reporting for us before and during the shooting and afterwards.
Now, this was well pre-cell phones and instant communication, Bob Giles. How did he get to the newsroom or get word to the newsroom that a tragedy had occurred? And what were those first few minutes like when you heard what had happened?
His name is Jeff Salat, and he, as a journalism student, he knew the layout of the journalism school building. The journalism school building was right in the center of where all the action took place. Jeff's assignment was to watch the developing rally. He found a telephone in the office of the director of the journalism school. And there was a secretary in the office named Margaret Brown. And he got her to hold the line, or the telephone line, open for him as he went outside and came back and reported the latest updates to his editor in Akron. And this exchange kept going on, and Mrs. Brown held the phone open for a long time for Jeff, and he was able to get the Beacon Journal the most accurate description not only of what happened, but to resolve a challenge to our reporting, because there had been an earlier report that among the dead were two National Guardsmen. And he said, no, the four students were the ones who were killed.
So he is anchoring the initial coverage out there, Bob, and I would imagine you, upon getting word of this, that's really scramble time in the newsroom.
Absolutely, because all this was happening on between editions. We had four editions on our daily paper in 1970, and so this was after the first edition, but before the second edition. And by the time the final edition went to press on the afternoon of May the 4th, we had a complete account of what happened, as well as the names of the wounded and the dead.
Back here on Connecticut Today on WICC 600, Paul Pacelli with you. The name of the book, When Truth Mattered, The Kent State Shootings. 50 years later, the account of Robert Giles, a young newspaper editor at the Akron Beacon Journal, on a day when a very dark chapter dawned in U.S. history amid a protest in the Vietnam era. Kent State University, 28 National Guardsmen opening fire on student protesters in 13 seconds. Bob, 67 rounds were fired by those guardsmen. We should say, as we did earlier, four people killed, nine hurt. One of the hurt was partially paralyzed. Why, Bob, that had to be the big question that you folks initially had to look into. What the heck Beck would have made National Guardsmen fire on ostensibly unarmed students.
They were all unarmed, and there is no explanation. Everybody has chased that angle of the story for a long time, and my book doesn't reflect on it in any particular way. What did happen was that the guardsmen carried out their assignment of chasing the students, dispersing the students, and it appeared that the rally had been broken up and they were heading back to their bivouac area, and all of a sudden they turned and several, 28 of them, as you said, turned and fired at the students. There was no command given. In the aftermath, the National Guard commanders tried to cover up and shift the blame from the guardsmen and lay it on the protesters. One of the early claims that was made is that there had been a sniper. That was disproven by some of our investigative reporting. We heard conspiracy arguments that the radicals were engaged in it and from the student side. But all in all, the guardsmen were to blame, and my story basically makes that case for them. One of the things that was very important, and you mentioned earlier, that Kent State is one of the singular events that people remember going back over history, like Pearl Harbor and so on. There was a photograph taken just after the shooting by a young photo student at Kent State named John Philo. And you'll all remember it. It's a young woman mm-hmm. with her arms raised in the air over the body of Jeff Miller, the dead student. That has become an iconic symbol of Kent State. And when people see that, they remember Kent State. And I have a chapter in my book which explains how John Philo got that picture and how it became such a singular representation of the terrible tragedy that happened on May the 4th.
It's fascinating, Bob, and having worked in newspapers for a few years, I really came to appreciate, even though I was a little photo bug myself, I really came to appreciate, Bob, the talent of so many newspaper photographers, how they capture these iconic images. And for many of us, all you have to see is that image, and you know where that was from.
Absolutely. That's very true.
So how did your staff hold up during this? How long was the investigation? And in the end, Bob Giles, were you happy with what your paper did at the Akron Beacon Journal?
Well, I was. It went on for weeks and months because, in fact, once the legal cases began to go to court, that lasted for 9 years. The final settlement was in 1979, but my staff just worked very hard. They were dedicated. They worked long hours. I worried about their mental health and the stresses they were under, but they put telling the story way ahead of anything else. And at the end, I was very proud of our coverage because we created a truthful narrative that has become the standard explanation of what happened on May 4th that the public has accepted, and that was a consequence in my mind of the trust between my newspaper and our audience that had been built up over many years. They trusted us to give them the best available version of the truth, and they trusted our effort to get it right. And I know there's a public hunger for truth today, and this is a time when getting accurate information is more critical than ever. And I hope that my book not only will give closure to a tragedy that the courts and the community could never achieve, but that from my book will come some thoughts for news consumers that will help guide them to find truthful reporting today.
And I think, Bob Giles, it reinforces the fact of how vital local newspapers are at a time, as you well know, when the local newspaper in many markets is struggling to survive.
Paul, you're so right. And I like to have the opportunity, as you're giving me, to make a plug for local journalism and its value as a public service, and to urge people to support their local newspaper. Buy the paper, read it, and learn from it, because the local paper is going to give you the best available version of what's going on in your community, and that's really important today. As you in your area, you're struggling with the virus, and the news organizations that are doing the best job are relying on the experts, and we've all become familiar with Dr. Fauci. He is an expert, and the fact that he has become singled out as the voice of accuracy, the scientific knowledge, the go-to guy when you want to really know what's going on, says something about the capacity and the need for strong journalism today.
The name of the book is When Truth Mattered, The Kent State Shootings 50 Years Later. Robert Giles has been the guest. Bob, thank you so much. We appreciate the time. Thank you.
Well, it's great to talk to you, and thanks for having me, and thanks for so many good questions. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate the time. All right.
Who maybe you know are not only doctors, but they're also in our state legislature, and I'd love to hear their perspective on from a doctor's point of view, what they're hearing from their constituents, what we're doing right, what we should be doing faster or slower, and other things as we try and work with the legislature through this. But first, let me just give you a brief update on what's going on over the last few days and what's going on in the last 24 hours. This chart is sort of reflective of where we've been for a while now. The death rate, blessedly, is slightly lower the last 5 days than it was the previous 5 days. Hospitalization is down. I think that's for 12 days in a row now. That's an important metric, as you've heard me describe before. Reason it's going down, as you can see from this next chart, is that Fairfield, Hartford, and New Haven are all on a downward trend. And the other counties have not really had a big uptick, thankfully, thanks to social distancing and taking that seriously, which we really appreciate. And again, the day-to-day change in hospitalizations, the three-day moving average, this is why we have the reopening committee, and this is why we're focused on a prudent way we can reopen. What we're going to do is tomorrow, you're going to hear from our Commissioner of Education, Miguel Cardona, and Beth Bai talking about what we're doing in K through 12, what we're planning in terms of summer camps, so we can give you real guidance going forward now through the summer. Later on this week, you can hear from the university group that put in place a really good plan for how we can slowly get our universities, colleges, community colleges back up to speed. And of course, you'll hear from the reopened Connecticut team probably on Thursday, as we've tried to do before. Just a brief overview. I just got out of our regular teleconference with the other governors and Vice President Pence and Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci and the team that's leading the White House task force. I'd say, I was going to say better late than never, but that's not really where I'm coming from on this. Finally, the PPE is beginning to flow, and it's coming from the national stockpile. I think you see there'll be a big shipment going out to all of our nursing homes direct from the national stockpile over the course of the next week, 2 weeks. I think you'll see the testing, the reagents, the swabs, as well as the transport is all going to start going to the states based upon a need to be able to do about 2% of our population testing on a regular basis. That'd be 70,000. So that is beginning to roll out, which we're really appreciative of. You probably heard that we've joined with our other states from Massachusetts right down to Delaware, including New York and New Jersey, for a joint purchasing cooperative. And again, you may say, well, Man, I mean, aren't we on the backside of this? Why do we have to do this now, just when things are beginning to flow? It's as if you're going to promise us delivery of the Christmas trees on December 26th. Aren't we over this? And the answer is no, we're not over this. And I think my fellow governors, a Republican and Democrat, are really smart. They're going to say, look, I'm glad we've got some flow coming from the federal government. I don't want to always have to wait to see if that plane lands from China. We're going to take this into our own account if we can. Let's see who has production capability, who has the pharmaceutical capability, who's got the swabs, who's got the agents. So us as a collective of seven states can work on this in conjunction. We don't give up any of our freedom of movement, but it gives us a better base going forward to make sure we're never stuck in the situation we were 2 months ago. And look, hope for the best, plan for the worst. I'm not sure what's going to happen this fall. I've heard a lot of different predictions from the experts. So that's why we're being cautious about reopening, and I want to be ready if there was another small surge later on this year. Some pretty good news, I think. You probably know that the federal government has been, pretty good, I think, when it comes to our small business and the PPP loans. And those are the loans that allow a small business to keep going for a couple of months, pays for all of their operating expenses, including a salary. And we did well in the first round. In the second round, we did very well. Really thanks, I think, to our banks, our community banks, our electronic lenders like PayPal and the such. Obviously, DECD worked closely with small business, minority-owned business, women-owned business to make sure they got in the front of the line. And we had over 30,000 Connecticut companies get a PPP forgivable loan in this round. That's $2.5 billion more to the state. This loan size is smaller than it was in the first round, but that also means more of our small businesses got access. And again, that's why we're focused on May 20th. We're focused on getting things reopened, just because we know that our small businesses just have enough firepower to get through over the course of the next couple of months, assuming they were eligible and got the PPP loans at all. One of the things I'd like to ask our doctors, Pettit and Anwar, is some of the interesting things we're hearing coming out of the healthcare community and the medical community. Remdesivir, as you maybe heard, is a therapy that even it didn't come from the non-doctors on the White House task force. It came from Dr. Fauci and others that said, perhaps there is some therapeutic value there that would mitigate, if not the risk, at least mitigate the amount of time you have to be in the hospital and perhaps save some lives, certainly save some times in the ICU unit. I'd love to hear what the doctors say about that. We're talking to a major Connecticut company just today. They're, being relatively optimistic on their trials for vaccine. It's a vaccine for folks under 55 and over 55. It's a vaccine they're experimenting in terms of different dosages right now. I'm not interested in the false hope business, but I am telling you the best of the information that I have coming in, and that's why we have two amazing doctors here on the phone. And I'll just leave you with this before I ask Saud Anwar to kick things off for a couple of minutes, and then Dr. Pettit, and then we'll take your questions. Whatever you hear coming out of the healthcare community, whatever you hear in terms of therapies, whatever we hear in terms of vaccines, when and if they may come around, Dr. Birx was very clear at the end of our call today. She said these are all hopeful signs, but nothing is more effective and more tried and true than making sure you stay true to the important discipline and social distancing you need. Number one, hygiene, keeping your hands clean, disinfected on a regular basis. Two, don't be dismissive of the mask. This is Dr. Birx say this. Three, timing. Wonder about where you are as a state. I've got big Boston over there and New York down there. That's why we're a little more cautious before we ramp up. She was pointing to other states where maybe they opened a little too soon. Mississippi had to ramp back, briefly, just because they saw a short spike. And crowding. Stay out of crowded situations as best you can. As you know, we had to close down our beaches after a certain amount of time this afternoon, this weekend, just because there was crowding at the beaches. We kept them open, but sometime around midday, we had to do that. Dr. Birx said, if you only have to go to the grocery store once a week, that's a lot better than twice a week. And if everybody did that, that would reduce demand by 50%, and what a difference that makes. That's the advice we're getting from the White House task force. So with that, I see Dr. Anwar is on the screen, so let me ask him first. Just to say a couple of minutes, if you could, Sab, before I hand it over to Dr. Pettit. Here you are, you're a leading pulmonologist. You're also in our state Senate. Give us some perspective on what you're hearing.
Sure. Thank you so much, Governor, for having me, and thank you for the hard work that you and your entire team has been doing. This is such an important time, and your leadership is so valuable, and it's helping save lives and then protect people. I'm in the intensive care unit, and I'm seeing the ugly face of the disease. This disease, by the time a patient gets into the intensive care unit, takes away their ability to exchange oxygen or blow off their carbon dioxide, and leads to multiple organ failure, including the lungs and the kidneys being the main organ, but the patients do get very, very sick. We are seeing heroic teamwork on the part of healthcare workers across our state. I cannot say enough things about the people who are putting themselves at risk at the greater good to take care of as many patients as we can. And that's the reason we have relatively good results in the state of Connecticut with the critically ill patients. Thankfully, as you have alluded to as well, that the number of new patients coming into the hospital has slowly started to decrease, but does not take away from the high amount of work that is required to take care of each and every patient who is critically ill. So that's part of what I'm seeing. Our ability to manage this disease is getting better because we are getting far more experienced in managing it, and then the scientific component is actually kicking in. We are putting a lot of pieces of the puzzle together to be able to manage this based on scientific criteria. I think the remdesivir gives a little bit of a hope because it does have an antiviral impact, and it does actually help us get hopefully lesser hospital days. That's at least all we can say right now. The severity of illness may decrease. The challenge is we have not been able to access it as of right now. We were using it for compassionate basis for children, and I have no experience taking care of children in the ICU, and pregnant women were offered it for compassionate basis. But now with the FDA's nod, there's a good chance that the access is going to improve. So that's good. But the plasma is something that if we can get enough antibody testing in the community, and if we can get enough antibody testing, we are hoping that more and more people will be able to donate plasma that can be very effective and helpful in reducing the disease burden or the severity of disease in many patients. So if people who are listening to your leadership, Governor, if we can get more people to who have healed and who are improved, who are about a few weeks out, about maybe 28 days in some respect, can actually give their plasma to help save the life of somebody who is in the intensive care unit. I can say a couple of words about what I'm hearing in the community about the work. There is anxiety, there's palpable anxiety, which is all across the spectrum. One is the anxiety of getting sick, of being unwell, and then not having enough resources in the hospitals to take care of that. Thankfully, with the decrease in the number of cases, the hospitals are a little bit better placed than they were about a few weeks ago. But then there's a financial anxiety that people are having as well, which is how are they going to be able to manage? How do they reopen the businesses? So there's a fear about resurgence and doing the right thing when they start the businesses, because the businesses would have to adapt according to prevention of disease in the customers, but also the workforce. So it's a very different way of looking at businesses, and then every single business will have to reassess how they have been doing things. But all in all, I think we are in the midst of a disaster. We forget that, and in the disaster, we are obviously stretched with our resources and capacity. The best way to do this is to actually work together in a collaborative way and try to have feedback mechanisms and systems to make sure we make the best decisions and continue to improve. And your team has been available to us literally almost every single day, and they hear my complaints all the time or concerns, and the feedback loop of them working towards addressing them has been very, very appreciated. And And hopefully, while I know your vision is to have May 20th to be opening time, I'm a little bit concerned from a medical point of view for that. And hopefully we can talk about that aspect. And finally, I'm sorry, I'm taking a longer time. There are concerns on the nursing home patients and the personnel in nursing homes with the personal protective equipment availability. If that improves, that would actually have more protection in place. And then those are some of the main areas that I wanted to touch on. And again, thank you for this opportunity.
Sal, thank you very much. Bill, I hope you could hear that.
I did, thank you. What I've been hearing is similar things to what Saud has heard.
Move your
You may want to raise your camera just a little bit.
Up and back a little bit.
Perfect.
Back at you a little bit more.
That's good enough.
Hearing many of the same things that Saud is hearing, there's a lot of concern. There was concern about capacity, which we seem to have met. When people ask, some people want to open up the state tomorrow, and I say, you know, you have to understand that incredibly dangerous. The contagiousness factor, the so-called R-naught, is 2.5. But once you're out 10 people removed from an initial case, you can impact upwards of 10,000 people.
Mm.
In addition, though, many of the fatalities have been in the people over 60, 70 years old. At times, and I'm sure Saud can attest to this, there's people in their 20s and 30s that come down with the disease and die within a couple of weeks. So we really don't understand the susceptibility and some of the genetic variations. As he noted, remdesivir may be helpful. It seems to have decreased the hospital days by 4 or 5. I would also note that it's important for people to know that many of the other drugs that have been mentioned, the hydroxychloroquines, chloroquine, other antiviral steroids, the Infectious Disease Society of America recommends it only be done under the auspices of trial, that because the data has not been very good with most of those other drugs. I hear some of the same financial issues, but what people are looking for from the reopen committee is very specific advice. In other words, if restaurants and nail salons are going to be open in 2 weeks, they want a specific list of things that they must do. And I'll give you a specific example. My public health director suggested that if there's going to have to be physical barriers in certain places, people need time to be able to obtain the raw materials and construct whatever physical barriers may be needed. The businesses need the time to be able to obtain the protective equipment, be it masks, gowns, gloves, sanitizing materials as well. Restaurants are going to be feeding people outside, they need time to set it up. They have to obtain tents and other facilities. Speaking with my health director, he was also concerned that we reinforce the basics, as you did, Governor. Masks still play a role. Not touching your face and sanitizing plays a big role. And if you're sick, you should stay home. There's people who are trying to gut it out sometimes and become ill and actually still show up at work. And if you are ill, have a fever, have a cough, you should not show up to work if you've been cleared by the medical system. So I think we can do what we're doing, that is begin to have plans to reopen, but have to do it cautiously so we don't see a resurgence of the disease. And I think what everybody out in the community needs is very specific guidelines so that they can follow those guidelines to minimize our risks.